1490 AM Denmark, W250 CD Green Bay, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. Calling it a very sad day for America, former President Trump appeared in a federal courtroom in Washington, D.C. to enter a not guilty plea to four charges related to the January 6th attack on the Capitol. ABC's Catherine Falders was inside the courtroom.
The judge read to the former president in court the counts one through four, asking him if he understood these counts. He looked at her. He said he did understand the counts. When the judge was speaking, he looked at the judge the whole time.
Those who support and oppose the former president rallied outside. The next hearing in the case is later this month. Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid says the state's Department of Public Safety arrested 26 fathers seeking asylum in the U.S. last month, resulting in them being separated from their families. A judge has blocked a proposed water pipeline through a wilderness area in southwest Montana intended to help a rare fish species. This is ABC News. One of the heads of the major studios feels actors and writers deserve to feel more valued.
We're hoping this strike gets settled as soon as possible.
Warner Brothers Discovery CEO David Zaslav wants everyone to get back to work, talking to investors on the second quarter earnings call Thursday and taking a bit of a different tone from Disney CEO Bob Iger a few weeks ago, who said that writers and actors need to be realistic in their demands.
Everyone needs to be fairly compensated, and they need to feel valued and feel that they're fairly compensated.
His studio, one of those represented by the AMPTP, elsewhere on the call, the company revealed the strike saved them about $100 million in production costs so far. Jason Athenson, ABC News.
Brazil's environmental minister says deforestation in the Amazon is down 60% compared to July last year. How much is too much to pay for a house? Sotheby's says Copper Beach Farm, with 50 acres of waterfront property, has sold for just under $139 million. That's believed to be a record in Connecticut. Andy Field, ABC News.
Thanks for listening to your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more on our website, civicmedia.us.
For the talk of Green Bay news, I'm Pete Schwabe. Here's what Green Bay needs to know. A man is dead after an officer-involved shooting in Neenah. Yesterday, around 4:45 p.m., a Winnebago County Drug Enforcement Group tried to serve a warrant to a 37-year-old man at a Commercial Street gas station. Police say the suspect displayed a weapon and was shot. The man was taken to the hospital, where he later died. No officers were injured. The Sheboygan County Sheriff's Office will lead an investigation into the shooting. The Wisconsin Department of Transportation has completed work on a stretch of Highway 41 in Okano and Brown counties. That's right, commuters. Major construction is done. The Wisconsin DOT says the $17.4 million project came in on time and budget. The funds were used to fix a 9-mile stretch and focused on base patching, replacing culvert pipes, pavement marking, and replacing overhead signage. The work took a little under a year. Pete Schwabe for the talk of Green Bay, WGBW 97.9 News.
It's so hot. Wait, now it's going to rain? It is summer in Wisconsin.
As much as we love it, we love to hate it too. Find a forecast you can count on, along with the in-depth details you need, only from the Civic Media weather team.
These extended conditions have led us into a flash drought. Sitting in these above average temperatures with minimal rain has swiftly altered the local climate.
Your weather and more for your part of Wisconsin.
On your local Civic Media radio station and streaming on the Civic Media app. Did you know the Wisconsin State Fair is 172 years old? It still celebrates the industries important to our state's history, like agriculture. But every year, new attractions and items are added. This year, there's more than 100 new foods to try. So what do you think topped the culinary list last year? Flamin' hot Cheetos, chicken on a stick, deep-fried old-fashioned, or pino pretzel popper brat? The answer's coming up. The Wisconsin State Fair didn't start in its current home of West Allis. The first was in Janesville along the Rock River, then moved to different locations the next 40 years. The original cream puff has been around almost as long. Close to 400,000 are gobbled up every year. So which food was number one last year? It was the pino pretzel popper brat. It came out on top. The State Fair is a true slice of Wisconsin, and it runs through August 13th. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios.
Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
She's the newest of seven elected Wisconsin Supreme Court justices. Janet Protasiewicz begins her 10-year term in August when she is sworn in. It's a long-time tradition which includes use of the court's seal created in 1848. But did you know it features the scales of justice, but not carried by a blindfolded Greek goddess? Instead, a hand holds the scales, representing justice is in human hands. It also means everything is official once the seal is stamped on any court documents. For Civic Media, I'm Terry Barr. Flowers, vegetables, and crab apples, some of the first Marathon County Fair attractions, and showed us proof those crops could grow there. Started in 1868 by the Agricultural Society, the Wisconsin Valley Fair in Wausau began as a place to buy and sell those types of goods. Today, it's considered one of the best in the state, featuring displays, demos, and big-name entertainment included with the price of your ticket. The Wisconsin Valley Fair runs August 1st to the 6th in Wausau. For Civic Media, I'm Terry Barr.
Missed your favorite show? It's easy to find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Apple, Google, or civicmedia.us.
And website formerly known as Twitter, at Green News Report.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Big news, breaking news. Former president pleads not guilty to crimes. I had to start there. I had to, because that's all I saw today. Breaking news. Is it really breaking? I think it's kind of broken news. But I saw it, you know, the emails, breaking news, breaking news, breaking news. Everyone had to be first. And, you know, I could have got up this morning, written the email, you know, right when I woke up, gone back to bed early, and just put it out for, you know, later this afternoon. And it would have been, because guess what? No surprises in Donald Trump making his trek, pleading not guilty. They didn't photograph him, which, you know, I got to tell you, I wanted to see a mugshot. But hey, his presidential portrait, good enough. Good enough. Now, here's the thing. I'm not going to spend a lot of time in the opening talking about it because everybody's talking about it. And we will get to it in a little bit. But I got to tell you, I'm focused on the Hunter Biden thing. I hadn't really cared about it before. Because, look, no one has drawn that straight line from Burisma, from Hunter Biden to Joe. There's been no quid pro quo. There's no smoking gun. There's no there. And the more the Republicans keep throwing this up and keep having hearings, the more it kind of, you know, major thud. A giant nothing burger time and time again. And I know, you know, they've got their narrative that they're playing. And their narrative is, you know, Joe Biden fired that prosecutor so Burisma would benefit. The testimony didn't go there. But that didn't stop Republicans from still saying it. And this, again, is another one of these moments where they spin their own narrative. They spin their alternative reality. And they keep hammering on that alternative reality, because they understand if they say something enough, if they repeat it often enough, if they go over it and over and over and regurgitate it time and time and time and time again, people are going to buy it. People, because it's, well, everyone's saying it. It must be true. All of the right wing, you know, blabosphere is regurgitating this stuff, because that's what they do. That's why they built it. And it's masterful. It works. It's convinced us that we shouldn't tax rich people. It's convinced us that, you know, corporate America gives us wonderful things because they're benevolent and we should be thankful. It's convinced us that privatization is better than us doing things for ourselves. It's really masterful how they've created this narrative and this alternative world that they just keep, you know, free trade is wonderful. It's great for working people. It's going to create so many jobs in third world countries for poverty wages. But my mind was focused on the Archer testimony. And as I was reading through the transcripts early this morning, because I was bored, and that's what I do when I'm bored, I started coming across some of the comments that Archer was making. Because, again, you know, you look at what Comer and the committee keep throwing out. It's a lot of BS. But this Archer was talking about, you know, did he believe that, you know, Burisma wanted this Shokin fired? And he's like, no, just the opposite. He said that the narrative that he had was that this guy Shokin was good for Burisma. Just the opposite of what Republicans are throwing out there. And the more this guy talked, the more you got the sense that this wasn't a quid pro quo scenario. This wasn't a business deal at all. This was a father concerned about his son. And the more I read through this, the more I my mind kept going to this place and trying to put myself in Joe Biden's position. I've got three kids. They are growing up. They are becoming adults. I worry about them every day. Some are making decisions I'm okay with. Some, maybe not so much. Put yourself in Biden's position during the time that this is, all of this stuff is supposed to be going on. His son Beau dies. He's got this other kid who's, you know, got all kinds of drug and alcohol problems. He's worried about this kid. And he calls every day. And I'm going through this and I'm going, he calls every day? You know, that doesn't sound like a business deal to me. That sounds like a father worried that his son, you know, who has addiction problems, maybe fallen off the wagon. Maybe needs some encouragement, maybe needs someone, you know, there every day, even out of his busy schedule of, you know, being a well-known politician, still taking time to worry about his kid. And I got to tell you, this image of Joe Biden, because look, I think of him as Uncle Joe. I think of him as a good, decent man. I may not have always agreed with his policies, and I may not have always agreed with the votes that he took while he was in the Senate. But I've never viewed him as someone terrible. I've always viewed him as that, you know, that decent family man, that Uncle Joe character, that person that we all knew that cared about people. And this is what came out of that testimony for me. Now, I know Comer and the Republicans and the rest of them, you know, they want to try and figure out how to muddy the line to make it seem like those phone calls were all about, hey, well, we got a big deal here, you know, 10% for the big guy. But I don't see it that way at all. I see it as this guy is someone who's truly caring about his kid and wants to know what's going on. Now, is the kid, you know, doing what people do when they have a name, when they have the invisible capital of a name? Yeah. He puts things on speakerphone. At a dinner meeting with a bunch of people. Hey, look who's on the phone with me. My dad. Is that shocking? Is that surprising? No. And they're going to try and turn that into somehow Joe Biden benefited from this. They haven't proven that. They haven't shown that. And I said from the beginning, there's nothing here for me until you can show me that direct line, that direct quid pro quo. Because from the beginning, I said, this is probably what it was. You know, kids, you know, not all the brightest. He's cashing in on the Biden name and using it as well, you know, Roger Clinton did, as, you know, Ronald Reagan did. Who was it? Michael Reagan, the guy, the talk show guy. He made a whole career out of the fact that, hey, that's my, you know, dad from another mother. Same thing with the Bushes, same things with Roger Clinton, same thing with Billy Carter. I mean, you can go back through all of this. You know, people use that invisible capital. Donald Trump, you know, without Fred Trump, without that Trump name, he doesn't get into the rooms he gets into. Jared Kushner. Now, my mind did go to Jared Kushner. My mind did go to the Trump kids. Now, I don't know why we're not investigating that. You got a Senator Elizabeth Warren who's saying we probably should be. But this is one of those things where understand what the whole Hunter Biden thing is really about. It's not about actual crimes. It's about the illusion. It's about giving the base the outrage candy that they need so that they can put things on the same level. Well, you know, Joe Biden, you know, did this thing that we've imagined, and that's the exact same thing as, well, these 78 charges and 560 years of crimes that Trump's done. So it's a wash. That's the argument. And I've had this thrown at me a couple of times where you just go, no, that's not how that works. That's not how it goes. You know, it's like the other day I was reading a Jonathan Chait piece over at the New York Times, where he's putting, and this is just absolutely mind blowing to me, he's putting Hunter Biden and Clarence Thomas on the teeter totter of justice, and they're equal somehow in his mind. Clarence Thomas and his crimes somehow equal to whatever Hunter Biden's being accused of. Now, let's start with the most obvious. Hunter Biden doesn't actually work for the government. Doesn't have an official title, doesn't have an office, doesn't collect a paycheck, isn't going to get a pension, doesn't get health care from the federal government, gets nothing. All he's got is he's got his father's cell phone. That's it. He can call dad every once in a while. Hey, how's things going? His father's going to call him. But no official power. Now, you throw in all of the Trump kids who did work in the administration. You throw in Jared Kushner, who did work in the administration, got $2 billion from the Saudis. You throw in Clarence Thomas, who is a sitting Supreme Court justice. There are massive differences, but my friends on the right are going to go, no. See, they both did bad things. They did things. So it's equal. And you go, no, it's not equal. It's never going to be equal. But understand, the outrage merchants, they need to keep pushing that narrative so that they can go, but. They can motorboat all day long, but. And they do it so well. You know, because anytime you bring up something with Trump, but Hillary. What do you mean, but Hillary? Trump had 4 years to go after Hillary. Didn't do it. Why? Nothing there. Didn't have a case. Sorry, didn't have a case. Now, the response I get back from people is, well, you know, Donald Trump was above the fray. He was above it. Now, remember, this is the guy who ran a campaign on lock her up. It was one of his main campaign promises. You know, it's what people wanted on his side of the aisle. This would have been a true I did what I said moment. But no, he chose not to as the narrative. Because for the good of the country, I was told, he chose to put down the partisan divide. And, you know, my response is always, you know, in what world are you finding yourself? And what is the substance in which you're ingesting that makes you so deluded? So the breaking news, Trump pled not guilty. We're going to see where this takes us. I do believe all of these trials have to be out in front. Do I like the fact that we're here where we are? No. But Trump did this to himself. At the end of the day, no matter what everyone else says, Trump did this to himself. And this most recent indictment, all Republicans doing it to him. All of them. So that narrative that they spin, this is Joe Biden's fault and Joe Biden's DOJ and Joe Biden's people. No, no, these are all Republicans. All of them. And what the January 6th Commission did, what they did really, really well, they had no Democrats talking about it. It was all Republicans. And I think you're going to see more of that. But I want to hear your thoughts. Are you surprised by the big indictment? Are you surprised that he showed up? I would have liked to see the mugshot. That would have been interesting. But he was fingerprinted. But we'll get more to that later. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I'll tell you, you know, the reality is the more we find out about this, the more you're going to have, wide awakenings. Wide awakenings of, you know, for me, the Giuliani story is just, wow, Rudy. Remember when Rudy was America's mayor? Remember when he was the guy? Everyone, you know, thought he was the guy? Wow, Rudy. Leaky Rudy. Let's go to the phones. We got Alice on line one. Alice, how art thou this fine day?
I am very well, thank you so much. May blessings fall upon you. So, I was with a right-wing friend of mine today, and a number of interesting topics came up, you know, including what was going on. And the only thing I can tell you, Rick, is I'm just wondering what alternative reality that they live in. Because between hearing, you know, Donald did this and that, the other, he's being persecuted because he's a Republican and did so much, and, you know, they're all victims.
Nonsense.
And the illegal immigrants, and then I was told that I was crazy because and a desire to change the topic before I lost my temper. I brought up something about driver's license, and which I should have just kept my mouth shut, because then that led to, you know, all the illegal immigrants getting driver's license, and that's why we had a real ID. And I was like, you know what really aggravates me is they call it a real ID, considering you get it from the same government agency.
Now, here's the thing.
In a bid to move things along.
Yeah, when you talk to these people about
nowhere.
Real ID, Alice, when you bring this up to them, who do they think push that through? And are they...
That was the Democrats, don't you know? Because I even brought that up. So I was just looking at them like...
No, it was James Sensenbrenner who did it in the middle of the night in a defense appropriation bill, if I remember right. I mean, it was something that got, you know, snuck in because everyone was against it. Conservatives, liberals, everyone was against it. I you know, my state of Pennsylvania, I'm still fighting against it, although we don't have a choice. So it's amazing to me to hear Republicans are going, no, we're all in favor of real ID to stop those illegals.
Yeah, I'm just going, oh, my God. But, and they're also voting for DeSantis. if Trump doesn't run. And I thought, oh, my God. So, you know, thankfully the visit ended shortly, and, you know, that was that. But what I wanted to really say was, do we really think that Trump's going to be able to keep his mouth shut like the magistrate ordered him to?
No.
I think we should, I think we should start taking bets on, you know.
And I don't want him to. I want him to continue to lean in. I want him to continue to be tweeting crazy stuff out. I want him to be everything that he is always, because he's digging himself a deeper hole.
I'm agreeing with you, but I'm still thinking we ought to just set up like a pool and say, okay, it's going to be this date, you know, because there's no way that he's going to be able to keep his mouth shut. But you have a good evening.
Thanks, Greg. Alice. I appreciate it. No, maybe a national lottery. Maybe this is how we figure out how to do, you know, solve that national debt problem. Maybe, who knows? Maybe this is one of the ways we go about ensuring that we can pay back some of the money that we borrowed during the Trump years. I don't know. The money that we gave away in massive tax breaks to the very wealthy. Just a thought. Now, here's the thing. Don't point at me and go, well, you Democrats run up that too. Yeah, they do, because they're digging out of the holes left by Republicans. And look, I am a borrow and spend liberal. I will wear that proudly. I will borrow money when it's at almost 0% interest rates and spend it on infrastructure and education and things that are going to make us better. Without question, any day of the week, every day of the week, that makes sense. Now, what I won't do is I won't do what Trump and my Republican friends did and go, oh, yeah, we're going to borrow a whole bunch of money and we're just going to give it away to our rich buddies. And they're going to pocket it. Yeah, see, that doesn't fly for me. Doesn't fly for me. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Today is a very important day in history. Today is the day the Patco workers went on strike. You may remember this. 1981 was the year. I remembered. I was in high school at the time, and I remember this going, this is a big deal. You know, 13,000 workers hit the picket line, members of the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, otherwise known as Patco. Reagan came out and said, if you don't go back to work in 48 hours, I'm firing the lot of you. And thus the shot heard cross the boardroom. The beginning of open season on organized labor and on organized workers. This is, pretty much everyone agrees, this was the moment that it was pedal to the metal. There had been the attacks on workers, you know, for a decade before. You know, they were slowly, you know, thanks to the Powell memo and, you know, corporate America's coming together and colluding, going, hey, we got to stop this organized labor stuff. They're sucking up too much of our profits. That's our money, darn it. And because of this, we saw a major downturn in organized labor and the power of workers to demand better wages, hours, and conditions. And look, you know, these folks were fighting for things that we need, you know, shorter work weeks, fighting against automation, fighting against deregulation, fighting against inflation. These are people who are fighting the fight that we should be fighting today. But the fact of the matter is, lots of lessons to be learned in this Patco strike, because, as I said, they were fighting in the moment to make sure that their wages weren't eaten away by inflation. You know, the 70s were high inflation period. My grandfather, you know, as I said, 1975, got three raises because of his cost of living adjustment in his contract, made sure that their wages didn't get eroded by inflation. And the Patco workers wanted the same kind of thing. They wanted a 32-hour work week. They wanted, you know, better working conditions, you know, better equipment to do their jobs. And they wanted to ensure that their jobs wouldn't be automated and they'd be done away with. And this is kind of a moment for us to look back and say, you know, the fight that they were fighting back then is the fight we should be fighting today to ensure that wages are reasonable for working people to be able to have a decent life, to ensure that working conditions are safe so people are both mentally, physically, and, you know, socially okay, that they go home in the same position that they came to work in. I don't think that's too much to ask. And overall, that, you know, we don't allow the pendulum to swing way to the far side of corporate America. And that's where we are right now. Corporate power is the behemoth. And what we've seen recently, especially at UPS with the Teamsters, you know, threatening to strike some 350,000 workers, it's one of these things where you go, reality, workers need to start standing up and taking to the streets. They need to start doing what these Patco workers did. Now, understand, this is the backdoorness of our Republican friends. Because as the story was explained to me, the Patco union supported Reagan in 1980 for president under the idea that when they went on strike, he would secure for them the things that they wanted and needed. That was already there. He was going to be their guy, made the promises. Yeah, we're going to be, I'm a former union president. I'm going to be there for you. And he was there for them, all right. He was there to not just fire them, but blacklist them for life, from any federal employment forever. That's how Republicans treat working people.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1981. That was the day 13,000 workers in the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, or PATCO, went out on strike. Highly stressed workers had been driven to nervous exhaustion by long hours, problematic technology, and brutal management. They wanted better pay and working conditions and a 32-hour work week. PATCO workers had proven that militancy bred victories throughout the 1970s. But public sector employers went on the offensive as the decade drew to a close. By the time Ronald Reagan was elected to office, automation, deregulation, and inflation had taken its toll. As Joseph McCartin details in his book Collision Course, controllers found new technology unreliable. They experienced, on average, a computer outage a day in critical moments of takeoffs and landings. As well, the Airline Deregulation Act and the Civil Service Reform Act became law in October 1978, serving to restrict union rights and worsen working conditions. By the late 1970s, inflation had tripled. Federal workers, unlike those in the private sector, lacked any COLA protections. Emboldened by their skill level, solidarity, and previous victories, the controllers walked. Invoking Taft-Hartley, President Reagan issued a 48-hour back-to-work ultimatum. In a historic move, he fired the strikers, jailed their leaders, and forced costly injunctions that spelled doom for the union and the labor movement. Many labor activists had hoped the Teamsters and machinists would walk out in support. Instead, the strike was a pivotal moment for labor. It ushered in an era of unprecedented attacks not seen since the 1930s. As Robert Weir notes, Patco's defeat touched off a new wave of downsizing, decertification, and concession strikes. The labor movement continues to suffer its impact today.
Little known fact, a leading cause of death in Texas is Governor Greg Abbott. Yes, by intentional actions and deliberate inactions, Abbott has used his gubernatorial policies to kill thousands of Texans, including his calculated refusal to extend health care to millions of poor Texans, including nearly a million children, his intentional denial of water breaks for outdoor workers broiling under this year's 100-degree-plus heat dome, his lethal deregulation of utilities, causing the state power grid to collapse for days in the deep freeze of 2021, with hundreds dying for lack of heat and water, and his shameful prioritizing of gun extremism over the lives of schoolchildren. These people are not dying accidentally, but are victims of Abbott's premeditated policies and political ambition. Consider his silly scheme of throwing $9.5 billion of Texas taxpayers' money into the ditch of his highly ballyhooed border security PR show. Grandiosely branded Operation Lone Star, it has posed Generalissimo Abbott as a right-wing border hero. Some hero, he has stretched miles of razor wire underwater in the Rio Grande, slashing the flesh of migrant families and trapping babies and pregnant women in the coils. And Abbott's state troopers have been commanded to shove exhausted and injured refugees back into the river toward Mexico. As one appalled trooper says, "We have stepped over a line into the inhumane." This willful cruelty is made ridiculous by the fact that Abbott's militaristic power play has totally failed to deter migration. After all, these families are fleeing for their lives and future. So he can wrap all of Texas in razor wire and they will still come and find a way in. This is Jim Hightower saying, Abbott can kill lots of them, but he can't kill the human spirit.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as I said, not shocking. There's nothing breaking news today about Trump pleading not guilty. But what is interesting is the charges. I mean, for me, you know, the fact that there's no seditious conspiracy, there's no treason, there's none of the stuff, the big ticket stuff that you would have expected. Because you got a couple of people who in that crowd of, what was it, 1,078 is Trump's number. Of the number of people who have come through because of January 6th, he is now number 1,078, I believe. But here to share some thoughts on the indictments and you know, maybe give us some of the prosecutor view of how this might go down. I've asked our good friend, former Alabama Senator Doug Jones, to come talk with us. Doug, thanks for taking time for us.
Always great to be with you, Rick. How are you doing tonight?
I am good. I'm looking at this, and you know, there's so many questions here. There's so much. You know, so much on this plate. I want to get into the charges, though, right away, because, you know, they're for most people, I don't think most people know what these charges are. Can you explain, you know, in legal terms that someone like me could understand what these charges are and what they mean?
Sure. Well, you know what? They're actually fairly simple. I mean, when you really go down to it, and people need to think back about the January 6th committee and all the evidence that they've heard from so many people, because so much of this evidence, Rick, is going to be the same witnesses, the same folks, you know, the Cassie Hutchinsons, the Mike Pences of the world, other people who came forward and talked about those November, December meetings and what Eastman and Clark and all these crazy and Giuliani said and did. So what has been charged was what is, I think, the most obvious charges out of this in the sense of the evidence, not what you could, you know, incitement, a riot and sedition and all, but the most obvious ones after you heard the January 6th committee is a conspiracy to obstruct a proceeding. That is the main thing that we go here. Count one is, let's see what it says. Violation of Title 18 is 371. That's just basically defrauding the United States. Count two is a part and parcel of that. That is a conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding. That is simply obstructing and impeding the proceeding to certify the certification of the electoral vote. Count three is the attempt to corruptly obstruct, impede an official proceeding. Everything that they're doing, including the fourth one, and that's one that I want to talk about a little bit more in a second if we get a chance, and that's the one to deny people their rights, the right to have to vote and to have their votes counted. An interesting theory on that I think has ramifications for the future. But the other three are clearly directed at every effort that Trump and his unnamed co-conspirators went through to try to stop the certification of the election. And you got to remember, Rick, you don't have to succeed in doing that, although they did for a period of a number of hours. They everything they did led to that insurrection, led to a work stoppage of the Senate and the Congress.
Yep.
And ultimately, it was not until the wee hours of the morning of January 7th where they finally certified the election. So it's really when two people or more agree to commit a criminal act and take steps in furtherance of that act. And it's laid out pretty well in this indictment.
Yeah, and look, if they could have gotten to Mike Pence and they could have hung him in the gallows there, they would have succeeded.
They would have ultimately, again, there was an obstruction. It just wasn't a permanent obstruction, okay? They didn't just completely stop it, but they did obstruct it. They delayed it. And they succeeded. I don't want people to think that what is alleged was a conspiracy, that the objects didn't succeed. The objects of this conspiracy actually did succeed for a period of time. They ultimately, you know, ultimately weren't successful, but they did succeed for a period of time.
No, it's incredible. And, you know, because as I was reading the charges initially, I'm going, well, this doesn't sound all that bad until you start looking at that. These are serious. They're still serious crimes. They're not what I had hoped for. They're not the seditious conspiracy and the ones that you know, I think, you know, most lay lawyers, would go, that's what we should be going after. But this is serious stuff that could end up with serious time. So of the cases that are out there, and because, you know, the classified documents thing is one, the DA in Manhattan is another. And then this, because we've got, you know, three not guilty pleas so far, you know, which as a prosecutor do you think is the most damning for the former president?
Well, it you know, look, there's a difference, I guess, between most damning and most likely to succeed. I think the most likely to succeed is a far different calculation that's very difficult, I think, to say right now, because it involves jury selections. It involves discovery and the challenge of evidence that we haven't seen yet. Remember, January 6th, we didn't see the defendant, Donald Trump, and his lawyers challenging the evidence, cross-examining witnesses and all. So in terms of success, it's very difficult. But in my view, the most damning thing here is in my view, clearly the indictment that came out this week. I mean, that goes directly. And again, every defendant is presumed not guilty. And that is that's a legal presumption, Rick. That's not right. Something to be taken lightly. Okay. But the charges go directly at the heart of our democracy and what these folks were doing. If a jury believes is to subvert that democratic process, just to completely destroy our institutions of government in order for Donald Trump to stay in power. And right. that's a real threat to our democracy. So in terms of damning, I think clearly this is the most damning allegations that we have seen.
No, because I mean, the reality is this is a conspiracy, you know, because I remember saying again, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but I've watched a lot on TV and you hear about the RICO Act and all of this stuff with all of this conspiracy stuff. It seems like this was going on. You had all these unnamed co-conspirators. You had people saying, hey, we can use the military to put down any protests against the insurrection by using the Insurrection Act. Hey, we've got this all these alternative electors that we've now created and we've brought. The web on this is enormous. And you've got the guy who came up with the theory of, you know, Pence can just not certify and we can change it. I mean, it really is remarkable.
But here's an interesting thing though, Rick, and we don't know what all the evidence that the special counsel has gathered on that. But yes, we have seen those allegations. We've seen all that. But in order for there to be a charge of any conspiracy like this, they have to do more than just simply talk about it in the theory. Hey, we might can do this. We might can do that. What about seizing the machines like Mike Flint talked about? You know, you can throw out all kind of ideas, but you've got to take steps in furtherance of the conspiracy. Those are called overt acts. And you've got to take a couple of overt acts in furtherance of that conspiracy in order to meet the elements of the crime. To prevent the very thing that Donald Trump is saying, to prevent First Amendment rights from being criminalized, where somebody just sits around and says, damn, I think we should just seize the voting machines. Yeah, well, I do too. Well, if they don't do anything in furtherance of that, no crime has been committed.
Right.
Okay. And I think that there is what you're seeing here is the old line prosecutor rule is to go with your strength. Go with what is simple, what people can understand, and it carries significant penalties to it. Yeah. Make no mistake, it carries significant penalties to it.
No, this is one of those things where you talk about the overt acts. I looked at January 6th. I know that, you know, a number of states sent fake electors. Someone put all this together in my state of Pennsylvania. There were a number of people, notable people, which is former Congress people, very, very high-level Republican operatives who put their name on a document. Now, of course, they had a, here in our state had a caveat that, well, if the official ones aren't, we're the other ones. But still, there was some coordination that went into this.
Remember, the Attorney General of Michigan has brought a lawsuit already, faked electors. We still are looking at a fake elector lawsuit and potential criminal charges in Georgia. I'm not sure what's going on in Pennsylvania, but I think Arizona has begun to look at that now. So we may not see the ending of that. But here's the other piece of that, is that you also may not see any direct involvement by Donald Trump in those, which would not, my guess is that they would have charged Trump in Michigan if they'd have had direct information about that. So it's what was going on at the time was just stunning. And it also is, I think, a very serious foreshadowing of issues that we're going to face in 2024.
No, it really is. I mean, if you'd have gone to Netflix and written this script, they'd have laughed you, 15 years ago, they'd have laughed you right out of the place. To think that we're in the moment that we're in. I mean, you were a federal prosecutor, right? Could you ever have imagined, us indicting a president? Look, there are a lot of times where you look back at a president's time in office and you go, oh, they did this. I look at the Reagan years and Iran-Contra and a bunch of other things. And you go, how did they not get indicted? But we've always gone, let sleeping dogs lie. I look at this guy, the crimes are so egregious and he's so... the documents thing is a perfect example for me. Had he just given them back, I think it would have ended right there. But it was all of the stuff that went along with it, the bravado, I just think he is his own worst enemy. And I hope he violates the judge's order. And I hope he keeps talking because we need that.
Rick, he said something today. I wasn't sure if it was before or after. But he said he was, to put it in his context, he was saying that he was being persecuted, going political enemies, going, political folks going after their opposition, whatever, weaponizing. That was his context. But he did use a phrase. He said, this should not be happening in the United States. And I agree with that. The United States of America should never have been put in a position at where we are now, where a man who held the highest office in this country is now facing a series of very, very serious indictments for his own conduct. And the people that are testifying, those that are bringing forth this evidence, the prosecutors are either independent or they're in various jurisdictions. But the prosecutors can't testify, Rick. That's the thing. Every lawyer says what they say is not evidence. Their arguments, nothing is evidence. The only evidence are going to be the documents and the witnesses. And we've seen the witnesses in January 6th, and it was Trump's own inner circle. So, yes, it's one thing I completely agree, not with his context, but the United States of America should never have been in this position.
No, I agree with you. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with former Alabama Senator Doug Jones talking about the breaking news. Trump pled not guilty again today. But I wanted to get your thoughts on Representative Mike Waltz, the Republican from Florida, who he believes that Trump should get special consideration. Because he was president, and this kind of stuff shouldn't be prosecuted for a former president because, he should get special consideration. I mean, isn't this the ultimate in no one's above the law? Isn't this kind of that moment?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, getting elected president does not give one a get out of jail free card at all. And it should not. Imagine what can happen if someone committed offenses. What would happen if all of a sudden the Constitution said if you're the president of the United States, you are just basically immune from state or federal criminal activity? Good Lord.
Well, but here's the thing, Doug. I mean, let's say he wins in 2024 and there is a chance that could happen.
Can't he just pardon himself? Can't he stop the DOJ from pursuing? I mean, couldn't he do exactly what you're saying?
Well, no, he can't give himself immunity to not prosecute. There's a difference between abusing your pardon privilege and just immunity from prosecution, which is what Waltz was saying. Yes, I think there's a legal question about that. But quite frankly, it appears if you just read the letter of the Constitution, he could probably do that, at least for the federal violations. If he gets convicted in New York, if he happens to get convicted, if charges are brought in the state of Georgia, that doesn't apply to him. He cannot pardon himself for anything but federal crimes, not state crimes.
So, you know, I've been reading a lot about this, and you as a former prosecutor, maybe you understand the defense a little bit better than I do. They're talking about a delusion defense. What are they talking about when they say, you know, Trump's, the legal team's teasing out this delusion defense? Is it just that, you know, he's not all right there? You know, he has a different belief and you can't prosecute him for this? How does that work?
Well, it is basically saying he is so narcissistic that he was delusional in believing that he actually won the election. That there, because there were, according to the indictment and evidence that we saw from January 6th, there were any number of his inner circle that was telling him he lost the election. The vice president apparently was telling him he lost it. His White House counsel was. But then you had a group of lawyers, which by the way, Rick, is another whole embarrassment for the legal profession, that all of these unindicted co-conspirators are damn lawyers. You know, I mean, we catch enough crap, okay? And, you know, and here we've got this literally wacko legal theories, but they present some delusional defense that he really believed it. I think that only can go so far. And according to the indictment, he may have acknowledged he lost several times. And it gets to a point to where the delusional defense of whatever they're trying to say, there is, anyone would be delusional to believe it. Okay.
Yeah, but here's the thing. And this is the weird part of this. And I agree with you. I don't know how you can look at 2020 and think that Trump won yet. And I point to this CNN poll. That finds 69% of Republicans and Republican-leaning voters say Joe Biden's win in 2020 was not legitimate. And that's up from 63% last year. So it seems like maybe Trump's delusional. Seems like 69% of the Republican Party, they're coming along for the trip.
Well, remember, I think that's true, but there's a part of that I think you got to separate a candidate, a president who has really spent a gazillion dollars, had the best, you know, pollsters around with him, had to file 60 lawsuits, okay, that he is monitoring every day, versus people who are just feeding off of Fox News, feeding off of headlines and Breitbart and Steve Bannon and those kind of folks. And they don't want to believe that their guy lost. They don't want to believe that Donald Trump lost. They want to believe that there had to be some other reason that he lost. And they've not done the due diligence. They've not done the work. They hear Democrats saying XYZ and they see certain folks in the media, but they don't believe that. But there's a big difference from where Donald Trump is sitting in the Oval Office, getting this information real time every day, very specific, getting updates on the lawsuits, what's being said, what's being done, okay, and literally all of this crazy stuff just being thrown at him. And sure, I am absolutely convinced he wanted to believe him, you know, but there were certain things that they, for instance, that they wanted to do, but they decided not to do because of the, you know, Jeffrey Clark was saying he should be the attorney general. Okay. And everybody else is saying if that happens, everybody resigns. So that didn't happen. So it's not like he was totally irrational. And I think you're going to see some of that too. Yeah. And I think that there will be some evidence where he acknowledged at least from what I see in the indictment, there will be some testimony that he at least acknowledged that he lost it. And here's two things, Rick, and I don't want to dominate this, but I want you to remember two things. One, in the first impeachment, in the call to Zelensky, he was trying to get Zelensky to open up a criminal investigation. And all, what he was saying is, just open it up. All you got to do is open it up. We'll take it from there. Okay? In other words, let me run with whatever that means, truth be damned, okay? Validity be damned. In this case, he said the same thing. He was telling Bill Barr, just say it's corrupt, and me and my folks in the Congress will take it from there. That, to me, is such an admission that the folks that are his supporters and people in Congress ought to look at and say, this guy's been playing us.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. That's an
excellent point. Just playing us. He had planned on playing us all along and for his own personal benefit.
I got to tell you, the hope is that all of this comes out, you know, as I've been saying all along through all of this. It's, for me, what's important is what is said under oath when they go into that courtroom with the judge and the book and the hand and all of that, not what Rudy Giuliani said in the parking lot of the Four Seasons Landscaping Company, but what actually gets presented into evidence. Last thing, before I let you go, I got to get your thoughts on, you know, You were a senator from Alabama. I hated to see you lose to the dumbest guy in the U.S. Senate. This thing that he's dug in on in screwing our military. And I got to tell you, it makes no sense to me why he would take such a hard line on getting the promotions to our military folks, leaving the Marine Corps without a commandant, all kinds of craziness. This makes no sense to me. Can you explain it?
No, I can't. Other than his grandstanding and playing political games with it, he seems to enjoy the limelight, despite the fact that he's catching hell for it. It is unpatriotic. It is un-American. It is an assault on the military in general, but it more particularly is an assault on the women in the military and the spouses of military men. It is one of those things that is It is unlike anything that we've had in our history. You know, Rick, a lot of people don't really, I think, fully understand that so many generals and flag officers in our military have to be confirmed by the United States Senate. It's not just something that happens within the Army. They have to be confirmed. And people are retiring, they have to leave the military at a certain point. And so those are vacancies, those generals, let's say a four-star general. Well, that cannot be filled right now by the three-star general that is set to move up. And that means that the two-star general that's waiting to be a three-star general can't move up. The one-star can't move up. Folks cannot. It's like I said this a minute ago when I was doing something on social media. It's like a log jam. You know, you got a couple of logs rolling down the river. They get to a narrow spot and they jam up. Well, all of a sudden, everything that's coming behind them gets backed up and backed up and backed up. And pretty soon it's like a beaver dam that the river is not functioning the way it's supposed to be. That's what's happening here. And he's doing it because of the Department of Defense's stand that they took following the Dobbs decision that basically said, if you are a woman in the military, or if you are the spouse, a female spouse, and you like access to reproductive services, including abortion, that are not provided in the state we have assigned you, okay? Not the state of your choice, but the state that we've assigned you. We will pay, we'll give you paid leave. We will pay for your travel. We will not pay for the services. And there's a big difference. This is not against the law, despite what Turberville says, but it is affecting morale. It is affecting the ability to retain lawyers. It is setting back our ability to recruit women in our military, setting it back years because we've worked so hard to get women into the military. It is unpatriotic. And here's the thing. Remember, Rick, you're old enough, to remember Walter Cronkite during the Iranian hostage crisis, okay? Yep. Well, every sign off on the news during the Iranian hostage crisis back in the late 70s, through 1980. Walter Cronkite would say, and that's the way it is, day 147 of the Iranian hostage crisis. Well, we're starting something on social media where every day we're going to give the number of days that Tuberville is having his un-American assault on our military. Today is day 147. Mara will do something for day 148. Well, we also got a petition. I got a petition going on my pack, the Right Side of History pack, that we're going to deliver to him when they come back in September. It's unbelievable.
It really is. And I guess if there's a positive thing that comes out of this, we now all know that, you know, all these years that we weren't paying attention, the Senate actually has a job that it does and has done very well until this moment.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.